I'm Gene Pasale, and this is Living History. This show explores the rich heritage of the Brandywine Valley, focusing on the people, places, and events over more than 300 years, which have played an important part in our American heritage. Each show highlights a local town, event, or personality who's had a notable influence on our culture. Before we get started, I want to let people know our call-in line is 610-701-9243. That's 610-701-9243. This day in history. In 1773, in Boston Harbor, a group of Massachusetts colonists disguised as Mohawk Indians board British ships and dump 342 chests of tea into the water. The Midnight Raid, popularly known as the Boston Tea Party, was in protest of the British Parliament's Tea Act, designed to give the East India Company a monopoly on the American tea trade. In 1811, in the Mississippi River Valley near New Madrid, Missouri, a series of earthquakes begins with one of an estimated magnitude of at least 8.6 on the Richter scale. The earthquakes were so severe, they caused the Mississippi River to temporarily flow backwards, giving rise to Real Foot Lake in northwest Tennessee. And in 1944, on this day, the Germans launched the last major offensive of World War II in Europe, the Battle of the Bulge, an attempt to push the Allied line of forces west from northern France to northwestern Belgium. It was the largest battle fought on the Western Front. Today's guest is local author, historian Bruce Mowdy. Many of our listeners know Bruce from his work as an investigative reporter for the Daily Local News for many years. Bruce is president of the Mowdy Group and spent more than 20 years in journalism, winning a number of writing awards for his investigative work before founding his own company in 1997. He's written several books focusing mostly on local and regional history, including September 11, 1777, Jailing the Johnston Gang, Unlikely Allies, which talks about Fort Delaware, Pickett's Charge, Richie Ashburn, Why the Hall Not, and Life with Flavor, A Personal History of Hers Potato Chips. Discovery ID Channel utilized Bruce as an expert during a recent episode on the Johnston Gang. He has also appeared on C-SPAN and has made multiple appearances on Pennsylvania Cable Network and Philadelphia and local television shows. Bruce has been actively involved with many historic and civic organizations over the years, and the Chester County Commissioners recently reappointed him to the Board of Directors of the Chester County Conference and Visitors Bureau. And Bruce is with us here in the studio today. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Gene, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me, and you missed that I used to be a radio host right here on the radio station WCHE.
That's right. You preceded me by several years. Tell us a little bit more about your background. I know you were with the Daily Local News for many years. I know you probably covered many interesting stories.
I actually started all my writing and love of history in newspapers when I was a young teenager. I might even been 12 when my grandmother gave me some newspaper articles from the Civil War written by my great-great-great-grandfather. And I've been writing professionally since I was a senior in high school and first was paid to cover football in the Chestnut League.
Now, you may have been slightly contemporaneous with a guy named Red Hammer, who was at the Bulletin for many years. Do you know Red?
I do know Red, and Red's like my role model, kind of calling my something like that. I remember Red. He was covering sports, and he was pretty much a legend with the Philadelphia Bulletin when I was starting out, and Red's a good guy.
Great guy. You know, while you were a reporter, you covered the infamous Johnston Gang and their murderous exploits around the region in the late 70s, early to mid-80s. When did you actually start investigating that story, and how long did you cover it?
That was the story that I really remember as a newspaper reporter. I think we all have one thing in our career that we really kind of look back on. It was the Johnstons. I started covering the courthouse in 1974 for the Daily Local News, and for the first couple of years I knew of the Johnstons and some of their gang members for kind of petty thefts and things, but in August of 1978 was the month when five of the murder victims that took place, and that really started about 3 years straight, that it seemed like every day I was writing one or two articles. I was out the nights that the police dug up murder victims. I covered both trials, hearings. I even spent a couple hours in a jail cell with Bruce Johnson Sr. one night.
Now, were all the murders in the Chester County area?
All that they were charged with, yes. I think Bruce Johnson Sr. was convicted of 6 counts of first-degree murder. I'm convinced he did 10. Other people think he did more than that, but actually there was one murder that I know of that took place while he was in prison, while serving a life imprisonment term for the other murders. But most of the murders took place in southern Chester County.
Any of them affecting people or entities outside of this region, or they're pretty much localized to this area?
They really murdered people that were snitching, that were part of their criminal operation, and the grand jury, what started most of it was the grand jury investigation by the federal government. And they were murdering witnesses, and a lot of them were gang members, and some of them even members of their own family.
Now, you mentioned the federal officials were involved. Now, why were they involved here at the local level?
There was interstate transportation of stolen property. The Johnsons were known for a lot of different kind of thefts, but there were more John Deere tractors stolen in this area than the rest of the nation combined, and they loved Corvettes. I think they stole over 200 Corvettes.
Oh, my Lord.
And chopped them up, and it was the selling of the stolen material that really gave entree for the feds to come in.
Now, for the trials, were there actual eyewitnesses that testified that they saw them stealing property, or they saw them entering a house where someone was murdered?
The murder trials, the thefts, not usually eyewitnesses, but on the murder trials, there were two gang members, Ricky Mitchell and Leslie Dale, and they were also admitted murderers. And since they took part in the murders, and they eventually turned state evidence to help convict the Johnsons. So, yeah, there were some eyewitness to the murders.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned you actually met a couple of the people involved in this line of killings. Where did you physically sit down with them?
Actually, I think I knew just about everybody. I knew all three of the defendants. I knew all the attorneys. The judge in the case was very helpful in my reporting, Judge Sugarman. He was a great guy. Bruce Johnson Sr., I actually spent 2 hours in a jail cell with him one night. I was really looking hard to get that interview, as were other newspaper reporters, and finally he agreed to talk to me, and I called the prison warden, and the warden says, you better get out of here tonight, because they were shipping him to another prison in the morning. So I went out and was frisked and sat down with my tape recorder and my pen and pencil and interviewed him.
Did you ever have any qualms about sitting down with convicted murderers?
Not really, because actually Bruce Johnson Sr. was older than me, and he was always very polite to me, always called me Mr. Mowdy. Mm-hmm. And they knew I was doing my job, and unlike some other reporters, I would actually sit and talk with them, and not that I believed anything that they told me, but at least I report, the Johnson said they were innocent. So they really didn't have any good reason.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't me, it would be another reporter.
I know you mentioned you suspected there were several of the murders. Has there ever been a kind of official or even unofficial estimate as to how many murders the gang actually did commit in total?
I think you got to look at the official count was how many they were convicted of. And like I said, the top number was 6 with Bruce Johnson Sr. But like I said, I think probably there's 10.
10 or perhaps even more.
A lot of people think a lot more, and there might be, because I used to get calls all the time after the book came out wanting to know about the death of this person or that person or a family, and they always thought the Johnsons were involved.
Mm-hmm. Now, your book, The Jailing the Johnson Gang, brought the subject to the attention of many people, not only here in the Brandywine Valley, but around the country. In fact, I was in graduate school at the University of Texas at Austin at the time. I believe I saw headlines down in Texas. So it did receive national news coverage. Can you tell us about your recent appearances on TV about this story?
Sure. the Discovery Channel ID called earlier this spring and said that they were thinking about doing a story on the Johnson segments for Evil Kin, and would I be interested in talking with them and taking part? And I said, you bet. They eventually got the go-ahead, the production company out of California, to do the segment, and they came out, and they had a copy of my book, and I did some telephone interviews with them, but then I spent about 3 hours one day answering questions at a hotel down here at 202 and Route 1, and it was pretty interesting. They had a lot of questions, and they just fired questions at me for about an hour and a half. And eventually the segment called Broken Bonds aired on Evil Kin towards the end of September of this year. And again, it's really caused a lot of interest in the story in the book, and the book sales are popping up.
That sounds great. You did mention to me in an off the mic conversation that the story did actually make Time Magazine, Esquire, a few other national publications.
Yep. Off mic is like off the record or not? Nothing's off the record. Yeah, actually, Esquire magazine did a piece. Time magazine did a piece. New York Times, a guy you might have heard of, Ben Franklin, actually covered the trial. That was his name. He's a reporter. It got a lot of national press.
Excellent. Well, I think we're just about to take a brief break for commercials, but stay on the line. Folks, listen in, and we will be back shortly with more from Bruce Mowdy.
Do you enjoy hunting and fishing? Do you have pictures of your prize catch? Now through December, that's all you'll need to be entered in the Ram Trophy Room contest. Just go to the Ram Trophy Room at PennsWilds.com. Show off a little bit, then submit your trophy picture, and you'll have a chance to win monthly prizes from Bosch, Steel, Mossy Oak, and more. And how about a grand prize from Under Armour? For official rules and more information, visit the Ram Trophy Room at PennsWilds.com.
Are you tired of looking up at that old, streaky, stained, tired, ugly roof? Tired of that ugly roof taking away from your home's curb appeal? G.P. Martini Roofing wants to solve your curb appeal woes with a new roof built with Atlas Pristine Shingles featuring Scotch Guard Protector from 3M. The only shingle with a lifetime limited warranty against algae, streaks, and stains. G.P. Martini's crews are highly trained professional installers of asphalt shingle roofs, and now with the power of Atlas Shingles and Scotchgard Protector from 3M, GP Martini will install a roof that will provide the lasting color you choose for as long as you're in your home. Let GP Martini Roofing have a look at that nagging leak, or just call to consult about upgrading the look for your prized investment. Call them today, 610-873-1696. Whether your need is residential or commercial, GP Martini Roofing has the expertise in-house to solve your problem, or to simply make your home or office look its best. 610-873-1696. That's the number to call. 610-873-1696. And one of those GP Martini trucks will be on its way to you.
Hey, there he is. How's it going?
I'm having a stroke.
Are you going to shake my hand or what?
I'm having a stroke.
Wow, you're not even moving your arm.
I'm having a stroke.
Are you okay?
I'm having a stroke.
Your face looks weird too.
I'm having a stroke.
Are you having a seizure or something?
I'm having a stroke.
When someone is having a stroke, they may not be able to say it with words, but their body language will tell you loud and clear.
I'm having a stroke.
You just need to know the sudden signs. Look for FAST, F-A-S-T. F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. Or S, speech difficulty. Then T, time. Time to call 911 immediately, because the sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in their recovery. Know the sudden signs. Face, arm, speech, time. Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
WCHE 1520 AM, Chester County's best commercial radio station.
Wait a minute, isn't it Chester County's only commercial radio station?
Oh, we're Chester County only. Chester County's best and only commercial radio station.
Uh, I'm Gene Pasale, and this is Living History. Today we have local author, historian Bruce Mowdy in the studio with us. Welcome back, Bruce. You've written several books, including one on the Herz family. I think just about everybody loves potato chips, and not many people know that the Herz snack food tour at their factory is given right here in southwestern Chester County, actually near a little town called Nottingham. Tell us a little bit about Jim Herz and the family and their operations there in southwestern Chester County.
It's a tremendous all-American success story. You had Jim Herr back in the 40s going to school. He did not complete high school education and worked on the Mennonite farm. He was in charge of the chickens, and one day he told his dad, said, "Look, chicken's not talking back to me. I need to get out into the public." And Dad said, "I don't have any money to help you, but you're free to go. You help the family." So he looked in the Lancaster newspaper, went ads, looking for a job or something he could do, and found Verna's potato chips for sale for $1,750. He did not know anything about potato chips. He borrowed the money and bought the company, which amounted to a beat-up delivery truck, a kettle to cook the oil, and a potato peeler. And from that start, you have one of the largest independent snack food companies in the United States. It's a really great story.
That's a fascinating story from rags to riches. One question I always wonder about involves the overall move, at least in recent years, towards healthier eating. Potato chips are delicious. We all know that. But they aren't exactly health food. And I'm just wondering, how does the Herr family handle this question as to whether they, you know, could make their snacks maybe a bit healthier or a little bit better for people?
You know, Gene, I've never really asked them directly that question. I know that they are concerned about health and the environment, and they do a lot of environmental things out there. But how I would answer your question is that, you know, moderation is what it really should be. I don't think anybody thinks it's great, even though we'd all like to get, you know, a gigantic bag of hers and keep eating and keep eating and keep eating. But I tell you, they taste so good when you have a hamburger or something. You know, those small bags are great. Also, the hers use really good cooking oil, which cuts down on the fat. And one of the reasons that the potato chips taste so good is because they change that oil regularly, a lot more than a lot of other companies, so you get that really good crisp taste. And like I said, you know, if you're kind of sensible about it, and it's a nice treat, and it's not going to hurt you.
Sounds tasty to me. Your book on Pickett's Charge at Gettysburg came out just in time for the celebration of the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg. That was 2 years ago. I know you've done quite a bit of research on the battle there at the Gettysburg National Historic Site. Tell us about your meeting with park officials and others who you have in-depth knowledge of regarding this turning point in the Civil War.
I started out, I was not going to do a book on Gettysburg. There's been thousands of books on Gettysburg. And I was just at the end of Pickett's Charge, the high water mark of the Confederacy, and I looked across, and I knew the Confederate story cold, and I just turned to my left, and I said, "Who are the Union defenders?" And looked at the other books, and they were all written from the Southern perspective, maybe 95% of the books on the South. So I called my publisher, and I said, "Let's do one from the Northern perspective," and my book's 95% on the North. I went into the park library and talked with the head historian, librarian, and one of the top rangers at the time, and they agreed that there really was not a book as I had outlined to them, and they were very helpful of pointing out things and kind of headed me in the right direction. And when I was in the library doing the research, I'd have a list of information I needed on regiments and units and people and different things, and the librarian every once in a while smile and he'd just say, "You forgot one," and he hand, you know, a file that I didn't ask for. And finally, he came out one day and he said, "You've seen everything we have on Pickett's Charge." They were extremely helpful there at the park.
I've been to Gettysburg probably 15 times. It's really a fantastic site.
You showed up at one of my signings, if I remember.
I was there, and I have a signed copy of Pickett's Charge. One thing that really struck me was walking the battlefield on the 150th anniversary of Pickett's Charge. I was there. I know you were there in town at the same time. It's really a sacred site. You can almost feel the presence of the souls who fought and died there. And I know that you've personally inspected dozens of Civil War artifacts from a private collection, many of which were used around the time of the Battle of Gettysburg. Tell us a little bit about that.
It was just finishing off the book on Pickett's Charge, and you're correct. It's just such a sacred place and a special place, and I like to go in when people aren't around and really try to just in my mind take a look and kind of try to think about what it was like at the time. And actually on the 150th as Pickett's Charge, right on the 150th anniversary, I was on PCN and I had my back to 10,000 people coming across reenacting that. But it is just such a special place.
It really is. You're currently doing a follow-up to your Pickett's Charge book. What will that cover?
And that's a little bit with the artifacts that you mentioned in the previous. As I was finishing my Pickett's Charge book, I was introduced to Craig Cobb, a great guy who has gained control of the largest private collection of artifacts from Gettysburg, and also it takes in the French and Indian War and War of 1812 and American Revolution. And Craig was kind enough to photograph some of the artifacts from my Pickett's Charge book and then said, would I be interested in writing the book on him and everything? And I said, you betcha. You know, I've had in my hands things from General Armistead, who took part in Pickett's Charge. I had my hand on General Barlow's saddle, and it was kind of special for me because my relatives who fought in the wheat field at Gettysburg first were under the command of General Barlow, and I wonder if they got to touch the saddle the same way I did. Thaddeus Stevens was personal friends of the work, and anybody saw the Lincoln movie, you see Stevens walking around with a walking stick. I had the real walking stick in my hand, and just it goes on and on. I think we've taken 800 photographs for the next book that I'm actually on deadline with Schiffer Publishing out here in Akron.
Excellent. That sounds interesting. Just for our listeners, if you are a fan of American history or just history in general and haven't been to Gettysburg, you really should visit there at least once. It's definitely on the bucket list for all major history buffs. It is an absolutely stunning site with over 1,000 monuments and historical markers. I never get tired of going there. And if you go into town, you'll stop at a place called the Farnsworth House, which has a tavern where they have literally dozens of mementos and artifacts from the filming of the movie Gettysburg. It's really a great place.
Also, they run that movie continuously up in the restaurant.
That's right. That's right. I know you're also working on a book about the Wyeth family and an event that happened back in the early 1980s. Can you share anything with us about that upcoming book?
Sure. I've been working on it, and with the Gettysburg book and a couple other writing projects have been put off a little bit, but my publisher up in New York says, when are you going to get this to me? So it's kind of up next. And it's a little bit of a spinoff from the Jostens. Some of the Josten gang members, not the brothers themselves, broke into Andy Wyeth's studio at the Granary a number of years ago in the hopes of stealing one Wyeth worth $1 million. And they actually came out with about 10 or 11 of them. And the story is they couldn't sell them and how they got it back. And it's a really nice story.
That's a direct link with the Johnson gang.
Yeah, actually, some of the people I mentioned in the Jailing of the Johnson Gang book will be in the Wyeth book.
Oh, interesting. You've been a reporter, must have met thousands of people over the years who can make fascinating stories for books. Are there any other well-known people who you've considered maybe writing about?
Yeah, it's funny. Books pick me rather than I pick the books. Like I said, when I was at Gettysburg, I didn't really set out, but that story came to me. My Richie Ashburn book's another really good one. I didn't set out to write about Richie, and I was down at the ballpark and met this usher who was his retirement job and just tremendous to talk about, and I liked listening to him. At the end of the conversation, he asked me what I did, and I said I write books, and he said he had a book. And he did. He was the guy that helped that did the Why the Hall Not campaign and helped Richie get in the Hall of Fame. So really, books, you know, select me.
They come in different ways. You've been actively involved with a lot of local historical societies and civic groups for many years. I know you're involved with the Main Street Downingtown group. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
That's a great group that tries to enhance the economic development of Downingtown. I'm also on the board of the Chester County Conference and Visitors Bureau, a great group to help bring people in to see the historical places that are here in Chester County. I'm a past chair of the Chester County Historical Society and a past president of the Brandywine Battlefield Park Associate. So, yes, I've been involved in a lot, and members of a number of organizations. One, I think you've heard of the Chads Ford Historical Society.
Yes, yes, I was on their board for a while.
And you have a relative that is.
That's right, that's right. We've both been involved in giving presentations on historical topics for several years, and we often meet people who have very limited knowledge of history. There are kids graduating from high school today who have very little knowledge of their own history. What are your views about how well the schools are teaching American history today?
I think they're doing a great disservice not only to students but to the nation. How can you prepare leaders that if they don't know why our country was founded and the principles that this county, the country is based on? I think they're doing really an awful job.
I would have to concur. I have to say that knowing that two of my sisters are teachers, and I have a lot of close friends who are teachers, and they all recognize that there are a lot of kids graduating from high school who just have such a limited knowledge. It's actually a sad situation. Aside from being an author and historian, Bruce has his own marketing company, Mowdy and Associates, and people can visit his website at www.mowdy.com. Bruce, you have several books out there. They're available through your website and also on Amazon.com. Is that right?
Yep. My books are Amazon through the publishers. Contact me if you want a signed copy. My email is my last name, M-O-W-D-A-Y, at M-O-W-D-A-Y.com. I'll personalize them for them.
Excellent. I have to full disclosure, Bruce and I are friends. We've been at Chad's Ford Days together for many years, signing books, doing various events together around the county, including recently at historic Sugartown. So some of you have probably seen us at different events. Well, thank you, Bruce, for joining us on the show today. Be sure to tune in next week, Wednesday, December 23rd at 1 p.m. Eastern, when we'll be talking with Jeffrey Oates, park ranger at Valley Forge National Historic Park. Thank you all for joining us today for Living History.